Welcome to Business Watch, where we're putting a busy week into perspective from a huge leak of documents showing how countries are trying to change a crucial scientific report on how to tackle climate change, where the leak reveals Saudi Arabia, Japan and Australia are among other countries asking the UN to play down the need to move rapidly away from fossil fuels. It also shows some wealthy nations are questioning paying more to poorer countries to move to greener technologies. And this lobbying raises questions for the COP26 climate summit, which is just over a week away, especially in light of the concern raised by the Presidential Climate Commission on conditionalities attached to concessional funding following the meeting with the climate envoys recently, to increasing noise and risk as the local government election approaches, with record high oil and petrol prices feeding a growing discontent out there. And the next fortnight promises to be a little more unpredictable than the T20 World Cup, which gets underway in earnest tomorrow. To put things into perspective, I'm joined by Ness and Nair, Senior Portfolio Manager at Sasfin, Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Richard Calland, Associate Professor in Public Law at the University of Cape Town and a founding partner of the Paternoster Group. Nesson, tech stocks climbed in Asia this morning following what we saw overnight in the US. It does seem to be that tech is benefiting from the good news that we've seen out of earnings so far. We've also seen China Evergrande making that bond payment. And the worries are now that central bankers are going to need to tighten monetary policy into slowing growth in order to tackle this persistent inflation. Those are the big themes. Should we be worried about any of this? Because really what this sounds like to me is normalization. This is welcome because of what central banks have been trying to do since the global financial crisis.
Absolutely, Michael. I think, it's probably makes more sense, from an investment point of view, the sort of direction that it's taking. But I just wonder, whether it's going to be short-lived or not. Those tech companies, and in fact, in the last sort of few weeks, you've seen a slight waning of the negative sentiment. And I'm not saying there's positive sentiment. I'm saying that the level of negative sentiment is reduced a little bit, especially as far as China is concerned. The concerns around Evergrande, I think a lot of people sort of extrapolated that into a general, concern about the Chinese debt-ridden property market. I don't think that's gone away. I think, it's still very much early days. And, I think it's maybe even a little bit early to sort of see or infer rather that there's a normalization taking place in markets because, the sort of impact of these high debt levels in China, are still to be experienced in the Chinese economy, in the global economy, actually. So, whereas I think it's something positive to take from it, I'm not entirely sure that it's we can extrapolate too much into the future as far as what we've seen so far this week.
Richard, I just want to get your view on this. And just from the inflation side, let's maybe put the China Evergrande story to one side for a while. But what we've been trying to achieve in global economies is a level of inflation ever since the global financial crisis and central banks keeping the policy rates really low, flooding the markets with excess liquidity. Now we're starting to see inflation, finally. Surely that's sign of a successful policy now, which we would have been more worried had there been no inflation after all of this money printing?
Well, indeed, as I understand it, the idea was, of course, to help the recovery, and that required some reflation and some expansionary policies, and that's what we've seen. And if there wasn't that kind of growth, if there wasn't some attendant inflation, it would indicate that actually the economies were still depressed. So I think you're right. It's, on balance, a good sign, but obviously one must keep it in hand. It can't run ahead of itself, and we know inflation hits the poor the hardest, and so one must be very careful with managing inflation. As the Governor General has said time and again, managing inflation is a progressive political thing, not a neoliberal one, as some of his critics like to say.
Raymond, what are your thoughts on the inflationary genie being let loose from the bottle at the moment? Should we be concerned?
Well, Michael, I think at this point I share what's been said. We ask for something, and then when it happens, we get distressed. I think that we do need some recovery in world inflation, but we've got to also see it before we panic against the background of recent forecasts by the IMF and others that they still expect the world economy to grow at something between 5 and 6%. Yes, it may be a tale of two recoveries. It's obviously not evenly spread across the world. So I'm saying to myself, look, let's get through this year as we see it at the moment. There are good growth prospects for this year and next year for the world economy. And let's just ensure that we manage the inflation in such a way. It's not easy. It's obviously very challenging. But the fact is that is the challenge we're facing. And at the moment, at least we're doing it in a context of positive growth generally in the world economy. And I think that really makes our task a lot easier if we want to engineer anything like a soft landing.
Absolutely. And so stagflation, I do think, is a little bit overblown because we are still seeing growth, at least. Nesson, George Soros once said that it's not whether you're right or wrong that's important, but how much money you make when you're right and how much you lose when you're wrong. Now, Bitcoin is near all-time highs, so everyone that has ever really bought Bitcoin and has held it is in the green. So if you bet on Bitcoin now, you're not wrong yet.
I must say, Mike, I completely sort of missed the Bitcoin train. And I was reading an article by Alan Gray that was sent out to its investors that, the theme of which was that it's very important. In fact, almost everything depends on when or what you pay for something. And I think, if I think about Bitcoin, I was never quite sure what I was buying, so I never really bought it. But I think in Bitcoin's case, it's more a case, the investment decision would have rested more on what someone else is willing to pay for it. And if you think someone else is willing to pay R1 million for one Bitcoin, and if you believe that, 10 years ago when Bitcoin was first launched, what was it launched at? $10? Something ridiculous like that. Then you could have indeed made a lot of money. But still, I think the fact that there's this ETF out now and giving people sort of a little bit more easier access to the sort of price fluctuations or the price increases, rather, which is what we've seen this year on Bitcoin. I think that's helped a little bit of liquidity, and that's obviously piqued a lot more interest in it, compared to buying it through a cryptocurrency account. But I'm not sure. It's something that makes sense for me.
And whether you can hold it if you've got an ESG filter through which you make investments, because we know Bitcoin mining is hugely energy intensive. And let's talk about what's going on with the COP26 meeting in Glasgow looming up at the end of this month, and the debate on climate change and how South Africa should manage our climate change challenges inevitably is dominating the headlines at the moment. There have been further decisions that are going to have to be taken soon, and more consensus needs to be developed about South Africa's future commitments regarding climate change. For example, we've got the ongoing serious divergence, and Richard, I'd like your comment on this, between government ministers here on the future role of coal-burning power stations. That's going to need to be resolved at some stage. In the meantime, we've got a couple of further useful documents on how we might manage and afford a just transition. We've got the Meridian document, we've got a document from Treasury, all very well researched and updated technical papers on how we finance a sustainable economy. And the latter is certainly intended as a foundational step towards encouraging more long-term investments in sustainable economic assets and activities. Indeed, what do you see as the important issues now as we build up to COP26 that need to further cement the consensus around where we're going and what needs to be done?
Well, Mike, as you'd expect in the run-up to what is going to be a really critical COP, a really important meeting place for all of the parties to the treaty and a six-year review of the Paris Agreement, there's a lot going on. And for South Africa, I think, as with many emerging market economies, the key issue is finance. And there's a big gap between the expectations of the Global South and what the developed world is willing to offer at this point. That gap has to be closed in the coming 2 weeks and by the end of the COP. Otherwise, the whole thing will break down, because resource management and a flow of adequate resources to fund just energy transitions is the critical lever for everything. And that we can see that in South Africa, of course. And Barbara Creasy, the Minister of Environment, has just issued a statement, a very good statement, almost word perfect, I would say, in terms of setting out South Africa's ambitions, its increased ambition, but also its expectations of the developed world, the expectations for a decent flow of concessional finance at good terms, not conditionality, but good terms, to lubricate the energy transition, which must get out of coal as quickly as possible.
But that can only happen, and Raymond, to bring you in on that point, if Eskom has the ability to invest in new infrastructure, new cleaner renewable technologies, and very difficult for Eskom to do that in the current environment where it is saddled with this debt burden of $400 billion. It's said that it can only really be operationally a going concern with half of that on its balance sheet. So we're effectively looking for 200 billion rand here. And the leader in the business day was all about the climate envoys putting too many conditionalities. What are the trade-offs here? I think if you look at it, the climate envoys are actually at risk of being left behind because there was new funding announced by the minister this morning of almost 15 billion rand.
Well, I think, Michael, the big ticket item for the world and for South Africa now is the issue of climate change. In fact, someone asked me yesterday if I got a phone call and I was told I'd been appointed to the Presidential Climate Commission, what would I do? I said I would resign. It's a huge challenge, and I wouldn't like to be in the middle of the trade-offs that are now beginning to close in. We can see now that this is where the rubber is going to hit the road, and some tough decisions have to be taken. In other words, I think we're now closer to what I would call the political economy of the trade-offs, not only for the world, but also for South Africa. And I think for South Africa to manage the trade-offs that will have to be made is firstly, as you've hinted, we need to get on the same page about our energy mix in South Africa and sort out the differences so that we have a clear sense of direction. Then on the financing side, there is quite rightly a commitment expected from the COP26, but particularly we're going to have to apply a reality test, looking at the total financing that will be needed over time. What proportion are we realistically going to get from the rest of the world, or at least from the developed world? And then what is left for us to manage over the next few decades, but in the next few years as well? Then we must also, because we can see this problem has arisen elsewhere, where there isn't coordination between the rate at which you are running down the so-called bad sources of energy on the one hand and trying to build up the good sources on the other. When those get out of kilter, then you get problems with your prices and supplies. That needs to be addressed, and I think that could be a useful point on the agenda. So what I think is important needs to come out of the conference, not only globally, but also for South Africa, to be able to then say, well, what are the tough decisions we have to take? Because I am saying also, yes, we want to give content to a just transition, but I would suggest that in South Africa's circumstances, it has to be a very just transition. And there are a number of variables that we will need to manage. So I think we need to come out of COP with good news that we can build on, and that we are ready then to also prepare the public gradually for the tough decisions that have to be taken, and that we have in our pocket at least some idea of how we're going to finance it. That's apart from the employment effects and some of the other issues, but I think we need to use the conference to pull this all together globally and then also domestically, so we have a sense of direction on how we can successfully manage the basic climate change challenge that we are facing at the moment.
Richard, I want to bring you back in here. I mean, how realistic is it with that BBC leak this week showing that there's already intense lobbying going on by nations on the issue of the science and saying, no, we don't want to transition as quickly as the IPCC report has already indicated we have to avoid catastrophic global warming on the one hand, and on the other hand, rich nations saying, no, actually, we don't want to pay $100 billion US dollars a year. It doesn't seem like this is going to be a COP with very clear and easily definable outcomes. Lots of contested space.
Extremely contested. And the question for those of us who follow the diplomatic stuff behind the scenes is whether the British, as the COP presidency, has used the extra year that was given to them by COVID to really build consensus by behind the scenes. You know, there are good cops and bad cops, if you'll forgive the expression. 2009, Copenhagen was a bad cop because there was very bad expectation management and not a good enough diplomatic work behind the scenes, whereas the French got it right in 2015. They used their not inconsiderable diplomatic prowess to really herd the cats in the run-up. I'm not sure if the British have succeeded with that yet. And of course, I'm not sure, frankly, whether there's the diplomatic nous to achieve that. The climate change COP team in Britain is doing sterling work against all the odds. I mean, one mustn't lose sight of the complexity of this sort of deal, that the vested interests involved, and the fact that not everybody sees the world in the same way. There are rogue political figures in the world, Bolsonaro, the Indians, Saudi Arabia, others, who really get in the way of a sort of sensible conversation between adults. It's an extremely difficult deal to pull off. But it's one that's got to be dealt with. And the political economy of it, as Raymond says, this is where it really matters. You've got to navigate that political economy and find a way of doing deals. The South African Just Energy Transition Finance is a perfect example of that. There's contestation here, there's contestation at international level, but there is a deal to be done if there's the leadership and the political will to do it.
The local government election campaign, it continues. The circus is gathering momentum as we move towards the election date of the 1st of November. 352 parties contesting. Wow, our politics has mutated like a virus. And we've seen the campaigners crisscrossing across the country, making promises, standing on roads, trying to woo voters with what they intend to do differently in the future. The issue is, do we believe them anymore, I guess? And Nesson, maybe just to bring you in as the first commentator on this, because I left you out of the climate conversation a little bit. I mean, do we actually believe, a bit of a cop out there, does business believe that it can actually shift the dial at a local government level anymore? Or have we just become completely desensitized to the politics and do we give up with it?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Michael. And, you know, I sometimes wonder, whether there's a sense of apathy, as far as South African business is concerned. But I must say, I'm not entirely convinced that is the case. I think a lot of people, businessmen, are just exhausted. There's just fatigue because it's always a sense that one has to fight the institutions, and I speak here of government institutions, in order to get anything done. You know, if you think about what the purpose of government is, and around about election time, my sort of mind migrates to what is really the purpose of government. And I think for me, in simplistic terms, government is there to ensure that future generations have a better quality of life than current generations. And now we can, if you use that as a basis, for assessing whether government is doing its job, go have a look at the local government, you have a look at the road infrastructure, electricity infrastructure, and ask yourself, whether future generations, are going to experience a better quality of life than what current generations are. And I think if you leave business out of developing cities and of developing this infrastructure, then I can't see government doing it on their own. So I think business needs to be brought in. And how do you bring business in is you enable it. So what I think a lot of businesses would like to see is government enabling them to be able, to assist in developing some of this waning infrastructure that we have, certainly at a local government level.
And a very good point, Richard. On that, we are also likely to see, I think, historically low turnout numbers, and that's because of the COVID pandemic, but also the rise of coalitions, even more so than in the past. And it can't be said that coalitions have really worked so far. I mean, that must be a real concern.
On both of those points, Michael, I think there's a lot of uncertainty. There's uncertainty as to whether COVID is going to have an impact on turnout, on attitudes of people. We've had very few by-elections this year, so there's very little recent data to go on to assess where people are headed and where people are thinking at the moment. But what I'm pretty clear of is that there are going to be more coalitions, not fewer ones, I suspect, despite the fact that the coalitions in Johannesburg, Tshwane, and Nelson Mandela Bay the last 5 years have not been a perfect example of stable government, far from it. So political leaders have really got to improve their ability to manage, build and sustain and manage coalitions far better than they have in the past. They've got to raise their game. And that's going to be a key test after the election. And the negotiations that follow will be tremendously interesting. And the strategic choices that parties make, do the DA get in bed with the EFF again? Probably not. Will the ANC do a grand coalition with the DA? Probably not. Does that mean we're going to have ANC-EFF type partnerships and government around the country?
Potentially, lots to consider, and as you say, very difficult to predict with the lack of hard data from meaningful by-elections, and that's what makes the next 2 weeks so uncertain. Raymond, what message should be sent to the future mayors and town councillors in the country from an economic and business point of view? What would you be advising them on now?
Well, I've said to quite a few business people who've complained, well, there's no one to vote for. I said, well, don't talk to me after these elections about any of your complaints if you haven't had your voice and your vote registered as part of the process. But I'm already looking beyond the 1st of November and saying, look, what business needs to do, this is an opportunity. There's going to be all sorts of new dispensations after, some more successful than others. But the fact is, you now have an opportunity to get your voice heard against the background of a series of things that have gone wrong at the local government level. So I would propose at two levels. Firstly, at the national level, I'd like to see, for example, Business Unity South Africa or perhaps Business Leadership South Africa talking to the South African Local Government Association directly to the mayors and saying, look, this is our agenda as business. We want to help you. Can we work out a more effective partnership in a sort of global national sense? And then at the local level, if you look at the local chambers of commerce and the business forums, for them to engage the new players in the same spirit and say, look, we now want to see if we can develop more effective partnership at the local level for local economic development. We talk a lot on this program about the macro aspects, the top-down things that have to be done. But there's a lot dependent on what comes from the bottom up. And local economic development is one of the major pillars that we want to see inspired and activated. So I think after these elections, there is a unique opportunity for business, both at the national level and at the local level, to effectively engage with local governments in a way it was not done in the past, which is partly why things went so wrong, and now hopefully build on the foundations of those outcomes for a better partnership between local government and local business in order to get outcomes and get implementation of the right decisions which will create a better life for all.
And just one area where I can think of that off the cuff for the listed property sector, for example, Nesson, whenever I attend a results presentation, there's always a slide in there, it's generally quite close to the front, about the increase in municipal rates and taxes. I think just over 500% over the last decade, well in excess of inflation, yet the commensurate services have gone in the opposite direction. So there is a real vested interest here for business to play a far more active role. How likely is that?
It's always going to be a challenge, you know. There's on the listed side, certainly the listed property companies that you spoke of, a lot of those costs invariably get passed on to tenants, and at some point in time, you know, you break the camel's back, and that's what we're seeing right now. You know, vacancies are quite high, people are looking at alternatives, to offices, working from home, and that actually affects the ability of these guys to pass on those costs. And ultimately, you're going to end up with empty properties, abandoned properties, you know, if it's not commercial any longer to maintain these costs. And so those local municipalities, you know, that relied on the income coming from these businesses are going to have to source it elsewhere. The question really is how do you get real meaningful growth? The truth is you've got to look at alternatives to what we've been looking at the moment. And that's really to grow the cities, to grow the municipalities, to grow the infrastructure, and to allow business to be able to grow in order, to be able to provide more and better services to consumers.
And employment as well, which we so desperately need. Richard, we've got a minute to go. What do you expect to see from this local government election? What are your forecasts in what is a very uncertain and unpredictable election? Do you see the ANC getting badly battered and bruised? If you look at social media, you would think they're going to, but we know Twitter isn't real life. How do you see it going?
Not for the first time, we're seeing the ANC getting its campaigning act together at the last minute. They always do it. They're lastminute.com. Will that take them over the line? I don't know. It's going to hinge, I think, largely on Ramaphosa's popularity in the country. And although the real issues are about local governance and service delivery, in many ways, this is a poll on him. And only he, I think, can rescue the ANC. So if the ANC get a decent result, it'll be because of the president. They don't, it'll be a problem for the president, actually, like it was with Zuma in 2016.
And that has broader ramifications at a national and certainly ANC and growth level as well that we don't have time to get stuck into. That was the good cop, the bad cop, and the middle of the road cop, I don't know, Neza Nair, Senior Portfolio Manager at Sasfin, who is joined by Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Richard Calland, Associate Professor in Public Law at the University of Cape Town with The Week in Perspective.